Good afternoon and welcome to the Nittany Lion Inn and to today's Penn State Forum. I'm Patty Satalia from Penn State Public Broadcasting. Our thank you, as always, to Tom Bauer and the Penn State Bookstore for their continued financial support of these very popular monthly luncheons. It's nice to see such a big crowd for one of our own guest speakers. And speaking of speakers, we are hard at work on next season's lineup, and there is still a little bit of time to make your wishes known. We have a suggestion box, which is right outside the main doors of the ballroom, and we invite you to write your ideas on a slip of paper and provide us with as much information as possible, including the name, title, and contact information for the person you have in mind, along with any in or influence you might have in bringing that person to Penn State. Or you may email your suggestions to Carol Griffin at cjg3@psu.edu. Mark your calendars now for Monday, December 4th. You won't want to miss this one. Our guest speaker is Frank DeFord. He is a regular columnist for NPR and senior contributing editor at Sports Illustrated. The title of his talk is Sports, the Hype, and the Hoopla, and that forum will be held at the Penn Stater. Each semester, students are invited to these special lunch events, and we've been fortunate over the years to get some top-notch student volunteers who write articles about the Penn State Forum, which appear in our monthly newsletter. And today we're pleased to welcome Salim Carter, who has taken on that assignment this year. Thank you, Salim. He's an undergraduate student studying history at Penn State, and we look forward to reading his article when it comes out next month. And thank you, or not thank you, but congratulations to Linda Higginson of Old Main. She's the winner of today's drawing, and she has won lunch for two in the Penn State Faculty Staff Club. Most of you have been attending the Penn State Forum luncheons for many years now, so for the newcomers, and we're really pleased to see new faces at these events, the Penn State Forum is modeled after the National Press Club. We begin with a 30-minute presentation followed by Q&A. We invite you to write your questions on the notepads that are provided at your tables, and Kathy Shannon and Jennifer Hessert will be circulating throughout the room during the presentation collecting those questions. As always, we will ask as many questions as time permits. One final reminder, if you have a cell phone or a pager with you, please turn it off. And now to introduce today's guest speaker, here's Penn State's Executive Vice Provost, President and Provost, Dr. Rodney Erickson.
Thank you very much, Patty, and good afternoon, everyone, on this glorious fall Penn State afternoon. I'm delighted today to introduce one of my favorite faculty colleagues. For many of us, thinking about the future means thinking about what we'll be doing next summer or perhaps 5 years from now. But in his area of expertise, Dr. Richard Alley routinely thinks about what is likely to happen hundreds of years from now. Dr. Alley teaches and conducts research on glaciers, ice sheet collapse, abrupt climate change, and sea level change. He has participated in several ice core drilling projects in Greenland and in Antarctica and studied what the Earth's climate was like thousands of years ago. Richard Alley is an Evan Pugh Professor of Geosciences in the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences here at Penn State. His research has led to more than 170 refereed publications. He won the Phi Beta Kappa Science Award in 2001 for his book, The 2-Mile Time Machine, Ice Cores, Abrupt Climate Change, and Our Future. Dr. Alley earned his bachelor's and master's degrees in geology from The Ohio State University and his PhD in geology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He came to Penn State in 1988 after a year at the University of Wisconsin's Geophysical and Polar Research Center. Since joining the Penn State faculty, he has been honored with the Faculty Scholar Medal for his research accomplishments and with both the Wilson and Mitchell Teaching Awards from the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences. Readers of Penn State's Newswire may have seen stories and photos of his field trips with students to the American Southwest related to his popular undergraduate course on the geology of the national parks. To say that Dr. Alley is an energetic instructor would be an understatement. Richard Alley's contributions have extended far beyond the university. He chaired a committee on abrupt climate change for the National Academies, and he has been called on to serve as an advisor on climate change to several governmental agencies. Dr. Alley is a fellow of the American Geophysical Union and has been honored with a Presidential Young Investigator Award, the Horton Award of the American Geophysical Union's Hydrology Section, and the Easterbrook Award from the Geological Society of America. Just this year, he received the very first Louis Agassiz Medal from the European Geosciences Union for his contributions to glaciology and his effective communication of scientific issues in the public policy arena. In making this award, the European Geosciences Union called Dr. Alley one of the genuinely catalytic scientists of the glaciological universe and noted that he had raised the stature of glaciology within the entire scientific community. I'm very pleased to welcome Richard Alley, one of Penn State's own faculty members, to the Penn State Forum today. His topic is, "It's Worse and Better Than We Thought, the Meaning of Global Warming." Richard Alley, welcome.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to see so many of you here. I do want to scare you a little bit, and then I want to bring you to somewhere that's maybe not scary before we get done. And so I would recognize people have paid us to do this, and I thank the people who've done this. I thank Penn State. I've had a wonderful run here. I am enjoying it immensely. I do work with the IPCC. I do work with the NRC, ETC, but I am not representing them, just me. I can't tell you what will be in the IPCC until February, so just hang on. We're going to finish with an optimistic view, I hope. And so I'm going to start you with a rainbow. This is East Greenland, and an iceberg and a rainbow, and there is good at the end of the rainbow, but it's going to take us a little ways to get there. And so you may remember somewhere back in school, the Reverend Malthus said, "Listen, if you don't quit breeding like bunnies, you're all going to starve to death." And unfortunately, there actually are places in the world that he has been a little more accurate than we would like to see. But overall, most of us have not starved to death. And if you actually looked at the buffet today, we're not in serious danger at the moment. And the truth is, very, very few of us spent all of last summer hoeing corn so that we would have enough to eat this winter. And the reason is because we're really clever and because we have tractors and we have fertilizers and we have combines and they're all run by fossil fuels. Our 2,400 calories a day, maybe 25 today, if you take our energy use and you divide it by the number of people in the country, we use 240,000 calories per person per day. We enjoy essentially the labor of 100 people working for us, and it's almost all fossil fuels. To reasonably good approximation, we have 100 willing workers that are supplied by fossil fuel. And we like this. This is a good thing. It makes us happy. Just a quick example. You fill up the car, it's 100 pounds. If you had to bring the gasoline home in gallon jugs rather than putting it in the car, it would be a different world right away. You burn that, you make 300 pounds of CO2 because you added oxygen, and where does it go? It wafts merrily away into the atmosphere, and you don't see it. Now, suppose that we could replay 100 years. Suppose that what came out of the tailpipe was not invisible to our eyes, CO2, but it's what used to come out of tailpipes. And so imagine just for a moment, okay, that the CO2 came out of horse ploppies. Now, it is a pound per mile. You're driving down the road, right? Okay, it's a pound a mile. We would cover every highway in America an inch deep every year. Even the ones out in the middle of the desert, we're going to get an inch. You can imagine what jogging would be like, you know? Okay. Okay, we are really, really good at this. We are going to take 500 million years worth of accumulated fossil fuels and we're going to burn them in 500. We're a million times faster than nature. And nature's going to have a time to keep up with us. It's not going to get there right away, and we might as well admit that. And eventually, this ends. There's this bizarre fiction out there that somehow oil companies are so stupid that there's vast pots of oil that they just haven't bothered to find, and they'll find them real soon. Don't believe any of this. Oil companies are actually pretty smart, and they sort of know where it is, and they sort of know how to get money out of it. Don't think oil companies are stupid. I worked for one just for a little while. Don't believe any of this. And while we know that eventually it's going to run out, we also know there's a lot of people in the world that look at us and our 100 fossil-fueled willing workers and say, hey, I want a piece of that. They're having fun. I'd like some of that, too. And so there's a very interesting thing that more and more people want this, and we're finding less and less as we burn it. Okay. Now, let's now go to the other one, which I think I'm supposed to be talking about, which is global warming. If we burn it all and then we switch, there's a pretty good chance that our great-grandchildren are going to shake their heads and say, what were those people doing? We have to switch anyway, but we will change the world, and we have very high scientific confidence that we will change the world a lot if we burn it and then switch rather than switching before we burn it all. And then we have to switch anyway, whatever we do. Okay, here are some curves. A lot of these came from ice cores. Some of them is work that's been done at Penn State, Todd Sowers' work. Carbon dioxide, I'm sort of pointing with my arrow there. 1,000 years ago, carbon dioxide was low, 800, 600, 400, and here comes us. And yes, we have changed the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Very, very, very high confidence. Nitrous oxide, we have changed. Methane, we have changed. Methane's mostly cow belching, but... and this is acid rain, and we'll come back to the acid rain because we changed it, but we've started to pull it back down. And that one is important in explaining climate change, but it's also important sort of as a clue. These things, we've changed the atmosphere. Anywhere you go, you see our footprint. The world is changing its climate. If you take records of thermometers, it is getting warmer. If you put the thermometers in the air away from the cities, it is getting warmer. If you put the thermometers in the ground, it is getting warmer. If you put the thermometers in the ocean, it is getting warmer. If you put the thermometers on balloons and take them aloft, they find that it is getting warmer. If you put the thermometers on a satellite and you look down from space, it is getting warmer. If you go and look at the glaciers, basically every glacier on Earth has gotten smaller over the last 50 years or so. And even the glaciers that are getting more snow have gotten smaller. And I'll show you one of those. This is a picture of Muir Glacier in Alaska taken in 1941. Bruce Molnia from the U.S. Geological Survey has been going back and taking pictures from the same place. He doesn't get exactly the same lens, but he comes pretty close. So this is 1941, a glacier in Alaska, the same place, the same glacier in 2004. Basically, every glacier on Earth has gotten smaller, and a lot of them are getting more snow. Okay, it's getting warmer. We know this with very high confidence. This is the hardest plot I'm going to show. We're changing the atmosphere. It is getting warmer. Are these two related? Yes, with very high confidence. Okay, what we have here, each of these panels has a red curve. The red curve goes from 1860 on your left up to 2000 on your right. The warming has continued, but this is just up to 2000. The red curve is globally average surface temperature. 1860 is as far back as you can sort of reliably go with thermometers. Before that, we have to use proxies. And you see lots of jumps and bumps and wiggles and a general upward trend. The gray band in each panel is a model output. And in each case, the model has been told something different. So in your upper left-hand figure there, the model has been told what we know about nature. What was the sun doing? What were volcanoes doing blocking the sun? When there's a big eruption, volcanoes block the sun for a little bit. And so the model has been told about the natural forcings in the system. And then the model says what should have happened from those natural forcings and what we understand about the climate. And it says, hey, 100 years ago, it should have been cold. And it should have been cold because the sun was a little bit dim, and coincidentally, the volcanoes were a little bit active. And it says early in the 20th century, we should have seen a little bit of warming going on, and we should have seen that little bit of warming because of the coincidence that the sun brightened up and the volcanoes quieted down. And then more recently, it says not much should be happening. Nature is not pushing very hard one way or another, but the temperature's going up. And so not much happening from nature, temperature up. Now, let's go over to the one on your upper right. That is human forcing only. The model has been told about our greenhouse gases. They accumulate slowly. It takes a while to get a lot of them up there. It has also been told about that acid rain, the sulfur dioxide, because when we put out other stuff from the smokestacks, they make the clouds a little brighter, and that reflects some sun, and that causes cooling. And so we do the volcano job with our smokestacks. Right after World War II, we were doing the volcano job with our smokestacks really bad. And we actually saw some cooling happen that's mostly dirty smokestacks. Then we cleaned that up at the same time that the greenhouse gases are still accumulating, and you start to see a warming come in. Now, in the bottom panel, and I'm sorry if you can't see over me or the lectern here, but in the bottom panel, you over here can believe this especially. The bottom panel, we have said what humans did and what nature did. And when you tell the model what we did and what nature did, and you put them together, the model matches what happened very closely. So that gray band and that red curve are almost right on top of each other. It used to be mostly nature. It is now mostly us. Very high confidence. This has been done with lots of models. People have looked at troposphere versus stratosphere, land versus ocean, summer versus winter, north versus south, all sorts of things. The models are showing skill. It is mostly us now with very high confidence. Now, 1,000 years ago on your left, this is CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. 1,000, 800, 600, 400, 200. Here we are. We have raised CO2 that much. It is very easy to measure. There's no argument about this. It's serious. Those curves beyond it are various possible futures as envisioned by the United Nations. Do we clean up? Do we burn like crazy? Does the economy tank? Does the economy grow a lot? Things to notice. In every one of those futures, the change envisioned coming is very large compared to what happens. We've barely started. In every one of those futures, it is going up when it goes across the year 2100. The world does not end in the year 2100. If we burn it all, we might get to 2000 or 2500. We would be on the next story or maybe the one after that. We've barely started. Now, these are histories of temperature from 1860 over here on your left. The some cools and some jumps and bumps, the cooling from our dirty smokestacks. The warming to date. The warming to date is about a degree. And the uncertainty is sort of a degree Fahrenheit to a degree Celsius, so it's a degree. It is smaller than the typical variability from winter to winter in a natural system at a place. It is small enough that your neighbor can indeed poke you in the ribs one cold morning and say, ah, don't you love that global warming? Okay, you have to be paying attention to see it so far. Those are various futures. There is uncertainty about the science. There is uncertainty about the humans. The uncertainty about the humans is now bigger than the uncertainty about nature. In every one of those futures envisioned, the change coming is very large compared to the change that's happened. In every one of those futures envisioned, the change is still headed up when you cross the year 2100. The world doesn't end then. Okay. We've known the physics. More CO2 makes it warmer. We've known this for 200 years. This is physics. This is the people that say when you drop your pen, it falls down. You know, when physicists are really, really, really good, and when it gets really hard, they say, oh, that's chemistry. that's biology. That's geology. Okay, they're really good. They know what they're talking about. Okay, the past makes sense with CO2. It doesn't make sense without CO2. The climate modeling is working. It is showing skill. This stuff's really good. Okay. Now, nobody cares. Right, so the climate change. So what? We care about what it matters to us. Now, this is a brief summary of some of the things. Most of the models tend to dry in the summer, the places where we grow our food. They raise sea level everywhere all the time. You've got a little island of wonderful species in some national park, and now they need to be 1,000 miles north, and there's us in the way. How do they get there? So there's real ecosystem impacts. Certainly they open the possibility of spread of tropical diseases. Various economists have been looking at this. And man, I'll tell you, if you want to argue about something, give up on climate and argue about economics. But there are now serious economists that are saying that we are looking at serious damages to the economy. 1%, 3%, 5% of the economy just from the warming that's foreseeable in this century. You know, that's not the end of the world warming, but it's something that matters. When 1% of the economy is $400 billion a year, that's a lot of money. And so that's the summary of the likely impacts. Very, very skinny. What I want to do, though, is show you something. We have a debate in the U.S. People say, couldn't it be better than that? Aren't you scientists trying to scare us? Well, yeah, it could be better than that. But what I'm going to show you is that if that estimate is wrong, there's a lot more room on the bad side. It's hard to get a lot better than what I just showed you, and it's very easy to get a lot worse. And this is where some of our research comes in here at Penn State. As you may know, this is Sridhar Anandakrishnan. As you may know, Penn State is a powerhouse in ICE, with people like Sridhar, Dave Pollard, Todd Sowers, Eric Lampkin, Don Voigt, Dave Roisch, Matt Spencer, Peter Burkett, and a lot more. We really are a powerhouse in ICE. We're really doing some very interesting things. ICE is great. If you ever get a chance, these are caribou up on the Greenland ice sheet. They run up there to get away from the bugs. And this is the edge of the Greenland ice sheet, this beautiful fjord coming down. The ice was a whole lot bigger 100 years ago. It ended way down here towards the bottom of the picture, and it's melted back over the last 100 years. And I'll walk you through in a minute what had happened as it advanced out and as it went back. It mattered to these people. This is the cathedral at Valsey on the coast of Greenland. 600 years ago, there was a wedding of the Vikings here, and right after that, they left. It's a wonderful moving place sitting there in the meadow for 600 years. And we've been studying what happened to them, what happened to a lot of people by reading the climate and looking at the ice. So this is central Greenland now. We are 2 miles up. We're on 2 miles of ice, and we are drilling ice cores, and we're studying them. And this is Kurt Cuffey and Wanda Kapsner, two former Penn State students who have gone off to do good things in the world. And they are studying ice cores. And Kurt's looking at the one on top to read the history of climate, how much it snowed, what was in the bubbles, and so on. Wanda's looking at the one on the bottom to learn how the ice behaved, and so on. And so we go and we create climate records, and we create things like this. 10,000 years ago is on your left. Today is on your right. The green curve is temperature in central Greenland, but it looks a lot like temperature all around the North Atlantic. There's a very broad arch here, which is features of Earth's orbit. There are wiggles, which are sun and volcanoes and so on. This little orange thing is the medieval warm period. That's when the Vikings built their cathedral at Valsey. It was warm enough to run a European farming economy on the coast of Greenland. And then the ice advanced, and it came down the fjord, and it got closer to their cathedral, and the weather changed into what we call the Little Ice Age. And that's what did in the Vikings. They couldn't handle a climate change that was that big. Right on the end, this is a little bit of a smooth curve. Right on the end of this is global warming coming in. It's now run up a little higher than this curve shows. But these are climate changes. These are climate changes that have been big enough to affect humans. They don't control humans, but they affect humans. We see them. This is interesting. If these little tiny weeny things over on the far right are enough to bother people, this sort of big thing that happened at the end of the Ice Age is certainly very interesting. In Greenland, it was about 18 Fahrenheit in a decade. It was basically big enough that everybody and everything alive on the planet knew that their world had changed. And so, you know, some places it was really huge, and some places it just sort of caught your attention, but it was sort of big enough that everybody knew about it. And so if these little wiggles are affecting people over here, that nature can do this is an interesting thing. If these little wiggles over here, this is the last 100,000 years now, if these little wiggles are affecting people, and that nature did this over and over and over and over and over again, and sort of everybody on the planet knew about it, is certainly an interesting thing. Okay, now we think we understand what was going on. And today, off of Norway in the winter, when water gets cold on the surface of the ocean, it sinks before it freezes. And if it was a little bit fresher, it would freeze before it sank. And the difference between a lid on the ocean when there's no sun in the winter and no lid on the ocean is about 40 degrees. And so there's a big, big, big difference there. If the water gets fresher before it's really hot, you worry whether it might freeze again. And in fact, we're freshening it. We're busily melting Greenland and doing other things up there. We hope that it's not going to do anything weird. But it's still possible that it will do something weird. And It's hiding out there. Now, this won't happen, okay? If anyone saw the movie, it's really funny. This will not happen. This might happen, though. This is a temperature change plot to the year 2049 if the North Atlantic starts freezing in the winter. Orange is warmer than today by up to sort of 8 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And blue is colder than today by down to about 18 degrees Fahrenheit. This is not in our forecast of the future. But if this happened to happen, it would be a big deal. There'd be a lot of people unhappy that they were getting cold. And every time in the past when the North Atlantic got cold, it quit raining in certain very interesting places, like out here and down here and over here and up here. And there's sort of a couple of 3 billion people live in those places now. So in the past, every time the North Atlantic got fresh enough to freeze in the winter, these places got dry. And so we're not predicting this, but you know, it's just possible that we force the system enough, we melt enough Greenland, we freshen the North Atlantic enough, that we kick the monsoon. And there's a lot of people live under that that want it to rain. Okay? This is a drought closer to home. This is a little sediment core, which we had nothing to do with, in North Dakota in a little lake. And 2,000 years ago is over on your left, and today is over on your right. And blue and green are wet, and red is dry. Now, you may possibly remember, you may possibly remember in the 1930s, we had this little problem with it getting dry in the Great Plains. It was dry in North Dakota as well as in Oklahoma. It was a dust bowl. It made really good literature. It made really bad living. And you see the dust bowl. The dust bowl shows up beautifully in this record. It's this little tiny wiggle right over here on the far right. Now, when it was warm in the North Atlantic and the Vikings were having fun in Greenland, the Great Plains had a little more interesting stuff going on. You got something that was sort of the dust bowl that came for 100 years and that went away for 10 and it came back for another 100. That's not in our forecast for the future, but nature does this. Okay, now, let me take you to some cold places. Interesting places to go if you get the chance. You can enjoy all the comforts of home. It's wonderful. Some pictures I got you, as I said, the folks at Penn State, Sridhar, Don Voigt, Hugh Horgan is in the middle over here as a student. They've sort of turned Antarctica into Penn State South Campus. doing wonderful things, learning about the ice, doing really great things. This is Antarctica, and there some of them are headed to South Pole here in another 2 weeks. And so this is Antarctica, and I'm going to show you some stuff about Antarctica. Antarctica is a big pile, and so let me talk just a moment about piles so we're on the same page. If you make a pile of anything, it tends to spread under its own weight. If you poured your iced tea pitcher in the middle of your table, it would spread. If you poured pancake batter in the middle of the table, it would spread a little more slowly. You make a pile of anything, it tends to, a pile of cats, you know, cats spread. If something is really strong, it won't spread. So the floor is not spreading under me because it's strong enough. If you make something slippery, it spreads easily. And if you make it bumpy or rough, it doesn't spread as well. So if you pour pancake batter on a waffle iron, it doesn't spread as well as it does on a greased griddle. And if you hold it in, it doesn't spread as well. So if we had the pile of cats, they're hard to get away if you're holding them in, okay? Now, there's physics in this, and I've got a picture down here of Notre Dame, and I've got a picture of a little diagram of the early builders of Gothic cathedrals actually found out that piles spread under their own weight. And that there was a tendency for the walls to spread out and the top to plump down and they would fall apart. And so they invented these flying buttresses to hold them up. And it just takes some of that spreading tendency and spreads it out to the ground. So the ground helps hold them up. Because all piles, including Gothic cathedrals, tend to spread under their own weight. Now, an ice sheet is nothing more than a 2-mile-thick, continent-wide pile that is sitting there spreading under its own weight. Snow adds on top. It does not build up and build up and build up till the world rolls over. It flows to the sides and breaks off or melts. Okay. If you made it spread faster, it will get out to the ocean and make more icebergs. It'll go somewhere and melt, and you would have less ice and you would have more ocean. And so if you make it more slippery or you quit holding it in, you'll raise sea level. Okay. Now, what happens? This is a picture on the surface of Greenland. The surface of Greenland on the edge melts. The water goes down big holes. It gets to the bottom. You know, if we made this really wet up here, I could slide on it. Water makes things slippery. You pour water to the bottom, it gets slippery. You're greasing the griddle. The ice goes faster. If it goes faster, it makes more icebergs. If it makes more icebergs, the ocean rises. And so there's a feedback here. Warming makes more lubrication, makes faster flow, makes sea level go higher. Not a good thing. Okay. Ice sheets, and this may be the big one, ice sheets have flying buttresses too. When the ice gets down to the coast, it doesn't immediately break off to form icebergs in most places. It actually stays connected to the ice sheet. It spreads over the ocean, and it runs aground on an island somewhere. Okay, now what's happened? The big ice sheet on top is really cold. It's not going to melt in a big hurry. It spreads. It makes these flying buttresses, these ice shelves that extend over the ocean, and there's friction. Some of the spreading tendency of the ice is being held up on those islands through those flying buttresses. Now, if you wanted to take out Notre Dame, you would be a bad person. But if you did, taking out the flying buttress would be a place to go after it. It's a weak spot. Taking out the flying buttresses is a way to go after an ice sheet, too. It is a weak spot, because while the top of the ice sheet is very cold and high, down low you can warm it and you can melt it, and at the bottom it's already in contact with the water. And so it's already at the melting point. You raise the temperature 1 degree, you take 30-some feet a year off the bottom in the ocean. Big difference. Okay, so ice sheets do have flying buttresses. They are subject to melting. And so I'm going to take you to Antarctica. Now, the little picture down here in the corner, everything in green is a flying buttress. There are flying buttresses all over the place. We're going to go to this one right up here. There isn't much ice behind that one, thank goodness. And that one is over here. And if you'll let me gesticulate and yell for a moment, this is the spine of the Antarctic Peninsula over my hand. It's this great mountain range, beautiful thing. Glaciers just dripping off of 10,000-foot peaks. This is the ocean over here in black. You'll notice the scale bar over my hand. They're 12 miles. So these little white dots up there are way bigger than aircraft carriers. These are giant, giant icebergs. This is the flying buttress right over my hand, the Larsen B Ice Shelf. It is something that formed at the end of the Ice Age as the ice retracted. It has been there for 10,000 years. When this picture was taken in the end of January 2002. It's been warming there. This picture is 5 weeks later. Whoop, sorry, we lost something here. Hang on, there we go. 5 weeks later, it fell apart. It just detonated. This thing is bigger than Delaware, and it just detonated in a very few weeks. Warming got to it, the water got in the cracks, it tore it apart. Now, the glaciers that fed into it when it got out of the way, when the flying buttress was gone, they're no longer held back. They're not held in. They are going as much as 8 times faster than they did. You unplug them, they go. Now, the real ice is not behind that one. That's just a little finger of ice. The real ice is down here behind these big buttresses. They haven't done anything yet. But, you know, it makes it worrisome if it gets much warmer. This is Greenland. I've turned it on its side for a reason. Blue is thickening. There's more snow in the middle as it warms, and it's thickening. Yellow is thinning. It's melting more on the edges, and it's thinning. Red is hemorrhaging. And I'll show you a picture of this. We're going to look right in this red one here. This is the Jakobshavn Glacier. It's coming at you from the great ice sheet in the distance. Rock on the side, a big fjord. These are gigantic icebergs that are just flushing out of this thing. If we get over it in our helicopter, our satellite, and we turn around and look at this from the side, we see this. In 1992, the ice came down the fjord all the way to here. It was possibly the fastest moving glacier on the planet. And then you see what happened in 2000, 2002, 2003, 2004. It sort of fell apart, and it roughly doubled its speed from what had been perhaps the fastest moving glacier on the planet. Warming got to that flying buttress, it went. Okay? Year 2000, this is a complicated plot again. 1960 is over here. 2005 is over here. That line way across the top is no change in Greenland. Everything below it is Greenland is putting ice into the ocean to raise sea level. 2001, the UN, through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, says we're not sure what the ice sheets will do, but we think they'll grow for the next 100 years because the ice flow won't change any and it'll snow more. Okay, so right here they say, oh, these will all go up as we go into the future. Uh-oh. They're not going up. Okay, Antarctica, the data are much stinkier, but it's sort of the same picture. Warming is happening, the ice flow is changing, and as the ice flow changes, they're putting water into the ocean, not taking it out. This is a scaling, it is not a prediction. If you were to melt West Antarctica, everything in red goes under. Greenland is a little more by itself. All of the ice, Florida is under. There's nothing in Florida that high. New Orleans, the deepest water was about this for about 2 weeks, and it was $100 billion. Now, let's go back then. We go and we look at the world and we say, what's our best guess as scientists of what we face? There are problems coming. Okay, it's not the end of the world, but there are problems. And this is science, so we're not sure. It could be better than that. It could be worse than that. And so it really could be a little better. But this best estimate had the ice sheets growing, not shrinking. It does not include a 100-year drought. It does not include a North Atlantic shutdown. It does not include a whole bunch of things that are over here. And so when you weigh this and you say, could it be better? Yeah. Should we count on it be better? Probably not. Okay. Now, we do have to change. Demand is rising faster than supply. Eventually, the fossil fuels run out. This report that came out last week said, you know, if we just look at the effects of warming, it's 5% of the economy. But if we include ice sheets collapsing and shutdowns and so on, maybe it's 20% of the economy. And then it said, you know something? We probably could fix this if we had some really serious investment in looking for solutions over the next decades. We probably could fix this for something like 1% of the economy. Okay, now, how would you spend that? 1% of the economy is sort of $400 billion a year. We spend a few percent of the economy cleaning up after ourselves now. We have toilets, we have sewers, we pay plumbers. We have trash collection. We have catalytic converters. You know, it's not the end of the world. On the other hand, if you get upset about government programs, $400 billion a year is real money. And if you're into invention, if you're into helping people, if you're into making money, you look at this and say, wow, $400 billion a year. How do I get a piece of that? This is, I think, very telling. It's very interesting. This was in the New York Times last week. Over here is a history of U.S. government investment in energy research. This is all energy. It includes oil. This is not just alternatives. In real inflation-adjusted dollars, we peaked in 79, and it's been cut in half. The oil companies have not picked up the slack. They've been firing people and laying people off. Over here, on the same scale, just as a reference, is investment in health and investment in the military. Okay, so I will leave you with two pictures. If you go to Greenland and you find a muskox, you should enjoy yourself. They're really cool critters. If they see you, they may get nervous about you at first, and they often will turn and run. But they don't run very long. You know what they do is if there's any weak ones or sick ones, they put you in the middle, and then they turn around, and they say, yeah, hi. I can handle this. I'm going to deal with it. I think they're pretty smart beasts. Thank you.
You began your talk today by mentioning the number of calories we may be consuming here today. So our first question is, a new study estimates that America's cars are burning 1 billion gallons of extra gasoline a year just to lug around the extra pounds of the overweight. Another study estimates that commercial planes burn another 350 million pounds of fuel for the same reason. In a society that prizes thinness above all else, just where do you weigh in on the latest trend of blaming the acceleration of global warming on obesity?
Yeah, 150 and trying to hold steady. Sorry. Obesity is not the big piece of it. A fair piece of it is the things that lead to obesity. So if we all walk to work or we all bicycle to work, we would not be obese. And we would, the little extra fuel we're using to drive ourselves around because we're a little bit fatter than we should be is very small compared to the big extra fuel we're using just to drive around. So whether we were skinny or fat, moving that minivan takes a lot of fuel. And so certainly if we were doing the things that would keep us skinny, we would not be contributing as much to global warming.
Class or on the job, are you always so active, or is it because you're speaking about global warming?
I think that I'm not completely boring even in class. This is fun. I mean, come on, let's be honest. You know, it's yes, we do work hard, and yes, we do sit in front of our computers and answer email, and that's no fun. But what we do, we are privileged. And what we do really is fun, and it really is interesting, and it really does matter. And, you know, we ought to enjoy it a little more, actually.
Has global warfare contributed to atmospheric warming? What studies have been done on this?
Yeah, just in the extent that global warfare does use fuel, it would contribute a little bit. It's probably not a big deal in the grand scheme of things. Where it fits in the grand scheme of things, though, is that if one is going to combat global warming, it will eventually be an international affair. Right now, we are the leaders in putting stuff up, and by far we're the major nation that puts the most up per person. But some others are catching up with us a little bit, and eventually no one country is going to do this, no one economic bloc is going to do this, the world will do this. And so getting from here to there is going to require getting along with each other at some reasonably high level. And in that sense, global warfare is very much pointing in the wrong direction. It just doesn't seem to promote the getting along with each other that leads to solutions.
What is a simple and honest explanation for warming and other effects to come that I can share with my children when they have questions? What directions or thoughts for the future can I offer them?
Yeah. You know, if we could see it, it would be so easy. That's the business about the horse ploppies. You know, we don't see it with our eyes. But the fundamental physics, more CO2 makes it warmer, is just so fundamental in physics. And very interestingly, if you find the prominent skeptics, the people that will show up saying, he's scaring you, don't listen to him, he's got politics on his mind, he's trying to do something to you. Even the very prominent skeptics say, look, more CO2 makes it warmer. There's essentially no sane and reasonable objection to that statement, that we are putting more CO2 up and more CO2 makes it warmer. It's a spin on how much you should worry about that. And so what do you say? This is good science. It really is good science. There is hope. It's not let's be honest. Humans are weeds. You know, we're probably the best weed that nature ever developed. We will be here. But the question is, will we keep a whole lot of us happy and healthy? Will we keep the museums and the universities and the art and the things that we like? And the more we are on top of things, the more we're not hungry and mad at each other, the better we do at keeping those. And so this is one of several environmental issues that you look out to the future and say, we can handle this if we see it coming and we respond to it. But there's some chance that if we ignore it, that we will screw up and we'll make enough people unhappy in the future that we'll lose a lot of things that we really like.
What percentage of the gas sent into the atmosphere come from nature? For example, volcanoes.
Yeah, volcanoes are actually very small. Volcanoes make a very big difference over hundreds of thousands to millions of years. Over this time scale, they're down in the noise, basically. There is a large flux summer to winter. So when the trees start growing in the spring, they go And you can actually see CO2 come down a little bit. So if you look at the history of CO2, it's bouncing up with seasonal cycles, because in the spring, when the trees turn on, they suck it down, and in the fall, when the leaves die, they put it back. But that one can't really change much. Plants, if they didn't lose their leaves, they would quit sucking it in and they would quit leaving it out, and it would just get smooth. And otherwise, if you make leaves, they fall off and somebody eats them and burns them. And so, yeah, there's a decent flux in and out of the biosphere, but we can't change that hugely. We could, if we doubled, sort of the amount of carbon in all the plants on the planet is sort of like the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And we could octuple it. So if we doubled the plants on the planet, we would make an inroad, but we wouldn't make a big inroad into what we're doing. And so it's really, mostly it's fossil fuels in the atmosphere at this point. A lot's going into the ocean now, but that's making the ocean acidic, and that gets harder. So,
speaking of the ocean, what effect will global warming have on seafood reproduction?
Yeah, I mean, certainly on reproduction, if you change the ecosystem, everything changes. So who does what, when, where they do it is going to be different. And so you're going to push ecosystems at a time when they don't need to be pushed. There's this general sort of rule of biology that one and one is often three. You know, if you see what's coming at you, you deal with it, and while you're dealing with it, somebody else gets you from the other side. And so we are putting ocean ecosystems under a lot of stress. Warming is going to force them to change more and more rapidly, and that can't be a huge good in the short term. Acidification of the ocean is fairly large. Carbon dioxide goes in the ocean, it makes acid. And so it shifts the ocean in a direction that's more acidic. If you are a coral, for example, you live in part by taking rocks out of the ocean and making rock. Coral reef is just a rock. Shell is just a rock that you happen to grow, and they happen to be rocks that dissolve in acid. So it makes it harder for you to do your job if somebody's pouring acid on you while you're trying to grow. And so that's one of the concerns for the long-term health of coral reefs, because coral reefs are so deeply entrenched in the ecosystems. It's clearly something that the scientific community says this is going the wrong way. There's not huge agreement yet on how fast and how bad, but it's clearly pointed the wrong way.
President Bush reportedly was so taken by a Michael Crichton novel that depicts global warming as a hoax that not only did he invite the author to the White House to discuss the issue, he asked him to testify before the U.S. Senate. Mr. Bush isn't the first American president to draw inspiration from fiction. The Kennedy administration, for example, liked to think of itself as the chivalrous kingdom of Camelot. Do you think the Bush administration's legacy might similarly be summed up by the title of Crichton's book, State of Fear?
Oh, dear. I actually have to admit, I have not read the novel. I did read the end notes, because the claim was that they summarized the science. They were a very, very poor summary of the science. They did not do justice to it. And certainly, if those end notes on the book are serving as the credentials under which one should be testifying to the Senate, I would not endorse it personally.
What do you think of recent suggestions that we pump particulates into the atmosphere as a way of temporarily reducing global temperature?
Yeah, this is an interesting idea, geoengineering, that in the past, you know, whenever we cause a problem, we usually invent some way to get out of it. And you can invent ways to get out of it that don't cause the problem, or you can invent ways to get out of it that mask the problem. And so one idea is, let's mask the problem, let's put stuff in the stratosphere, let's put stuff in space, let's do something that just blocks a little bit of the sun, and that'll cool us off a little. It doesn't help the ocean, because the CO2 is still making acid. It raises a huge pot of questions. What happens if we let it warm up 10 degrees, and we put 10 degrees of cooling up, and we're keeping them in balance, and the thing breaks? Boom. You get the whole change right now. And the abrupt is harder to deal with. So there's worry about that. How do you go internationally? How do you convince the world that whoever is doing this is completely trustworthy and is not going to use it against them or play with it in the future or threaten to turn it off? There's real international issues. What do you do when somebody says, we'd like a different temperature? So you're setting the temperature 2 degrees warmer. We want 3. Let's have a fight. Let's have a lawsuit. You froze my tomatoes. I'm going to sue you. So it is a very uncharted world that one goes into if you try to tweak this. And there's real questions, what does it do to acid rain? What does it do to a number of other things? I think it's worth looking at. I think that you want your policymakers to know the options. And so scientifically, you should have somebody looking at it. But I don't think we know enough about it that you'd want to just jump in.
In your examples of the slow-paced warming trend, won't agricultural advances far outpace the loss of untillable land? Do the next 10 generations have a free ride?
I hope they do. I'm not completely optimistic. Certainly, agriculture advances are amazing. And, you know, the success of the land-grant schools, the success of the county extension, the outreach programs, it's just tremendous. It's one of these things that the university does not spend a lot of time patting itself on the back. It probably should. But if it doesn't rain, it's really, really hard to make plants happy. And so there is worry about that. There are limits beyond which it gets very hard to win on this. We now are doing a lot of groundwater mining. You go out and you fly over Kansas and eastern Colorado and you look down and there's bullseyes. And those bullseyes are simply mined groundwater that is being taken out of the ground tremendously faster than it is put back in. And so if you mine that and then it gets dry, now it's harder to have that agricultural advance that involves pulling up the stuff that isn't there anymore. And so I'm not convinced that it's a free ride. I am convinced that this is, again, I personally believe in what we do. I personally believe in the institution, in thinking, in smart people, in smart students. And I personally believe that if we are not investing in smart people and smart students and smart research, that we are completely screwed. So there's no free ride, but I think we can get there, but I think it takes foresight and investment.
How might U.S. environmental policy have evolved if Al Gore had been elected in 2000?
I'm not even sure I want to go there. I really and truly don't know. I actually have had contact at fairly high levels of the government on both sides of the aisle. Whether that translates into policy is a very different question, but I think that there are people on both sides of the aisle that are at least paying attention now.
What would you say to someone who suggests that more research is necessary to warrant the implementation of policies that affect climate change?
Certainly more research is necessary. We need to do better, but every year they pass a budget. And they pass a budget based on economic projections that are made with models that I am reasonably confident are very much less accurate than the climate models that we're using right now. If you were going to ask where are the big uncertainties that go into their decision making, is it in the fundamental science that more CO2 makes it warmer, or is it in the side of how does policy work and how do people get along and how do we implement this? It is primarily not in the science. I think our uncertainties now are very small and very muted compared to the uncertainties about what is wise to do. And not talking about what is wise to do because there's a little bit of uncertainty left in the science just doesn't strike me as forward-looking.
What are the main questions to be answered through research concerning global climate change?
Yeah. Well, in terms of impacts, I still think ice sheets are as big as anything. We have on one side the ice sheets will grow over the next 100 years. That was the forecast in 2001 as a central estimate of the response to warming based on the United Nations. We have on the other side, we might lose a couple of ice sheets over the next few centuries, and that might mean losing all the coastal cities of the world. And we can't do a whole lot better than that. The climate modeling effort is dozens of government labs with dozens of employees each running big models scattered around the world. And the ice sheet modeling effort is a couple of postdocs at Penn State and a couple of them at Brussels. And there's a difference of an order of magnitude or two here in investment. And so I think ice sheets are a big deal. Beyond that, I really and truly think that we know enough that this is coming, that we are going to need energy alternatives, that this does matter to us, and that it is soluble if bright people work on it for a while, that I don't know if you should tell them this or not, but they don't need to give me much more money. They need to give the Energy Institute money. They need to give the material scientists money. They need to give the chemists money and the biologists money so they can learn how to get together and make silicon do what plants do. They need, we should be into what are the options now. And I'll go around and talk for free. You don't need to fund me anymore. I'm sorry. The ice sheets still matter, so you should fund our postdocs. But
okay. On that note, I have one final question to ask our guest. I'm going to join you up here to do that. But before I do, unlike many people who talk about global warming, Richard Alley walks the talk. Tonight, while some of us may get in our car and drive to the gym, Richard, who by most standards already has a pretty faint environmental footprint, is going to be riding his bike home from work. We burn off carbs. Richard burns off carbon points. So for all that you do and for so enthusiastically sharing your research and what you've learned from that with us today, on behalf of the Penn State Faculty Staff Club, we thank you very much for being with us here today. Thank you so much. And we present him with the official Penn State Forum certificate and also with this mug. And I think it's a safe bet to say that these thank you gifts probably will not end up in a landfill, although there's no promise that it won't end up being recycled. Thank you again very much.
And
our final question is, among the prominent critics of a wait-and-see approach to global warming are Barbara Streisand, Tim Robbins, Susan Sarandon, and Meryl Streep. Do you agree with them that we should act now, or do you think we still need to hear from, say, Paris Hilton?
Oh, dear. Like I say, I think we should hear from the biologists and the chemists and the physicists and the material scientists. I think that we need to, I don't know the answer. And if I knew the answer, you know, I'd go run for office and get on with it. I don't think I'm the person to tell you the answer, but I think that we should get serious about talking about the answer. The idea that the science is still so uncertain that we should argue about the science of whether we're changing the climate and whether we will change the climate, it just doesn't hold water anymore. The evidence is good. It is not perfect. This is science. It's not revealed truth. But the evidence that we are going to affect the climate in fundamental ways and that will matter to us is very, very strong. And we should now be having the debate seriously among real thinkers, what can we do that will make us all happiest?
Thank you.
You have been listening to Richard Alley speak at the Penn State Forum, recorded November 6, 2006. Copies of the forum are available by calling Media Sales toll-free at 1-800-770-2111. That number again, 800-770-2111. This has been a presentation by Penn State Public Broadcasting.